Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is Veronica Monet. We're going to be talking about sexuality. Oh, what a big surprise. It is the Shame-Free Zone. We tend to talk about sexuality quite a bit, actually. Tonight we're going to be talking about sacred sexuality, or at least some branch of that that's a little more oriented towards indigenous cultures. My guest tonight is Amara Charles. She's been on our show before. And she was just releasing her brand new book, The Sexual Practices of the Kadushka. And she's back now, having been on a book tour, I believe. She'll tell us about that in a minute. And she's actually had some very favorable comments about her book. I think it's doing rather well. I'll just read a couple of them here. My friend and mentor, Annie Sprinkle, says, "This hotly anticipated Brave book is a treasure trove of wisdom that raises the bar on sex education and will create an uplifting sexual paradigm shift for many readers." And then Pamela Madsen, who's also been on this show, she's the author of the book Shameless. She says, "If you are ready to go deeper into your own sexuality, pick up this book." And then Betty Dodson. Betty Dodson, I met, oh my gosh, I'm going to think about 20 years ago, in Samantha Miller's apartment on Chestnut Street in San Francisco, back when we were shaking the world up with the sex worker rights movement and trying to infiltrate National Organization for Women with our sex-positive message. Betty Dodson was right there. She's the author of Sex for One, The Joy of Self-Loving, and her comment about Amara Charles' book was, "It is as playful as it is profound." Now, a couple of comments about Amara. She actually began her apprenticeship with Thunderstrikes within the Sweet Medicine Sundance Path of Turtle Island in 1987, and she has taught Kadushka sexuality workshops since 1990. She's also the author of Sexual Agreements, Aching to Open, and Erotic Touch for Two, and she lives in Phoenix, Arizona. Amara, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Hey, it's great to be back. Hi, Veronica.
I'm glad to have you here, and I'm sorry, but since you are in Phoenix, I just got to ask you, have you been following the Phoenix Goddess Temple arrest?
Well, of course, you know, I know a lot of those people, and some of them are dear friends of mine, and they are warriors and warrioresses, and they are doing okay, and they appreciate the loving support of anyone who supports what they do.
Yeah, well, I have never been to the temple, and I've never actually met Tracy Elise, but I have quite a few friends who have, and I've been following the case, and I'm just horrified at how incredibly sexually repressive the state of Arizona is. I can't believe that they want to create a felony charge for people who provide orgasms. It just blows my mind.
Well, yeah, and yeah, I've lived here for about 15 years, and it's also a mecca for spiritual sexuality. We do have our places, and it's a very bold move to have the goddess temple here. So,
yeah.
You know, I wish them well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your book. Have you been doing a book tour? If so, where did you go?
Well, yeah, I've had a really fantastic book tour. We hit number one on Amazon, and then I was off and running to Australia and New Zealand, and then I also went to China and Nepal for more spiritual reasons.
My God, you hit number one on Amazon?
In our category, yeah, we hit it in two categories, mysticism and religion. So,
excellent.
Yeah, so it was, and we're still, and we're still within 50 to 100 in those categories on Amazon.
Oh,
so it's
wow.
Holding steady. So I'm thrilled.
Fabulous, fabulous. So what do you think the appeal is? Are people maybe looking for this spiritual sexual connection, or what do you think it is?
Well, I think it's hopefully what a lot of people are telling me is it's real practical. I mean, it's spiritual, but it's not like way off in the stars and all kinds of language that people can't understand. It's really very useful, and I think I've got to say that the hottest part of the book is about the sexual anatomy, and people really want to know what kind of man or woman they are. Like, you can be a horseman or a wolf woman or a buffalo woman, and it's just fascinating teachings based on your sexual anatomy, your physical anatomy. It influences how you are as a lover, how you like to be seduced, and that kind of thing. And I just think people are... they're just very turned on by wanting to know what kind of sexual anatomy type they are.
And, I mean, that really does speak to a question that I actually posted on Facebook earlier this evening, which was basically, you know, how much control do we really have over our sexual attraction to others? Do you think we're born, you know, more with a psychological overlay, or is it about the relationship, or, you know, pheromones, the way you smell, body type? A lot of us think it's what we see, that's what we're attracted to, but actually I think what, you know, some of the things you're going into point to sexual compatibility having a lot to do with our bodies.
Well, it's all a factor. I think it, rather than figuring out what is the reason why we're attracted, I think the more interesting question is, well, how do we respond? What do we know about ourselves as a lover? And how can we respond to someone else? The world is full of change, and we're going to be attracted to different kinds of people, or maybe just one person. And the question is, bottom line, how do you respond? Can you respond with sensitivity and intelligence and so forth? That's what interests me.
Well, I think, well, that's well said. But what about, like, if you are a deer or a horse? I mean, what does that even mean?
Well, what it means is that we have a particular sexual anatomy type, as I said, based on our physical anatomy. I'm a wolf woman, for example, and so I'm not limited. It doesn't mean I have a rigid way of going about things. It means I have the tendency to respond with my mind. A wolf woman, like the wolf, is like a lone wolf going on the hunt. She's very intense. She likes to literally howl at the moon. She makes a lot of noise during sex, and it's a natural thing for her. And so when a woman finds out what anatomy type she is, she can accept who she is as a lover more naturally. And so the same thing is true for the men. When a man learns that maybe he's a bear man, that means that that means that in his sexual anatomy type, his physical nature is he's very strong and potent and powerful as a lover. And it also means he has a dreamy quality to him. He likes to, like, go into his cave. And so there's also a horseman. Well, what I like to say about horsemen is that they're like horses. They are very stubborn and strong-willed and very powerful lovers. But you don't want to corral a horse. You don't want to keep him caged in. He's got to be free to roam. And so these are things you can find out about yourself as a lover. What are your natural tendencies? Not that you're limited by those tendencies. It's a place to start on the wheel, and it's a place to find out what can you liberate inside of you that's natural, that maybe isn't being expressed.
And when you talk about anatomy now, because it actually sounds like you're talking about personality, but you said a lot of it has to do with anatomy. So do you draw a distinction between those two, or are they related to each other?
Well, our physical anatomy affects our demeanor. So as a wolf woman, I have a particular anatomy structure, the size of my lips, the depth of my cave, the position of my G-spot, and so forth. A sheep woman has quite a different sexual anatomy. She has a long tunnel, for example. Her clitoris is a long hooded covering, and so she likes a lot of oral sex. She tends to be fairly deep, and she tends to be very wet and sweet-tasting. And this affects her demeanor. So her demeanor is, like the sheep, is very sweet, very kind nature, is very alluring and seductive. And so she is one of the gentlest lovers and very strong like a sheep woman. So you see, the physical affects the demeanor. And so what you're calling the psychological overlay. And so they work together. So your physical structure affects how you are as a lover. It also affects things like how long it takes you to reach orgasm, based upon how close all of the erogenous zones are to one another for the woman. And the same is true for the man. His physical anatomy affects his nature as a lover.
So how do people determine what kind of physical anatomy they have?
Well, hopefully you'll get my book, and I have drawings in there, and it would guide you. And look, and the other way is to come to a Kordoshka workshop and see. You know, the best way is to see. I mean, I do private readings for people all the time, and you know, I give them insights into their sexual anatomy type.
Oh, tell us about the private readings. That sounds exciting. So can this take place in your office or over the phone? Can people do it over the phone, or do they have to, like, do a webcam, or how does that work?
Well, I selectively, you know, I like to keep out, you know, some of the more crude riffraff, but I do private readings. And yes, we can do it through Skype, but mostly I do it through private and personal meeting in my office. And so we have a private meeting, and then I can tell them a lot of different things about themselves as a lover according to their anatomy type.
Wow. Okay. So do you have to see what people look like, or can they just self-report? How does that work?
If they're more comfortable self-reporting, they can describe it, and looking at the drawings in the book, that they can, it's very clear, so their distinctions are all explained. The very detailed descriptions will tell you, you know, exactly what to look for and how you can determine your type.
Very fascinating. Now, does this originate out of Native American tradition, does it, or something else?
They're not coming from Native American traditions. They are from the Mesoamerican cultures that predate the Native American cultures. A lot of the Native American cultures have been very Christianized, and they do not recognize these teachings. And so the Kordoshka teachings predate from the Mesoamerican cultures, from the Olmec and the Toltec traditions of South America.
Wow. Very. So, and how did you find these things? Were they in books, in cave drawings? Or is this oral tradition?
It's a totally oral tradition. I've been an apprentice for 26 years on the sweet medicine path, and so I have learned most of what I know, directly through practicing, through workshops, through my teachers, and so forth. So it's a very experiential learning over many years, and there's only 12 authorized Kordoshka teachers in the world.
12 in the world. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. Is this in other countries, or is this primarily in the United States?
It is in other countries. It's Germany, Sweden, Italy, the United States, Australia, New Zealand. And I've traveled to quite a few places to teach internationally.
Beautiful. So in your workshops, now you teach workshops too?
Yes, I do. I'm teaching a workshop in Ecuadorska, a workshop in Chicago in July, the 26th of July, Ecuadorska 1 and Ecuadorska 2. We went there last year to Chicago, and it was fantastic. Then in October, I'm teaching Ecuadorska 1 in Hawaii. And I just got back, and I was teaching in New Zealand, so I do travel, yes.
So you travel?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. It sounds like you travel a lot, frankly.
Well, I tell you the truth, I just got back. I was away for 4 months, and I just returned from Nepal. That was the last leg of my journey. I had been to China, Australia, New Zealand, and then Nepal. And Nepal was just amazing. I mean, it wasn't like anything I've ever been to.
So you were. This was part of your book tour, though, right?
Pardon?
This was part of your book tour?
New Zealand and Australia, where China and Nepal were more of a spiritual retreat for me.
Oh, okay. All right. And I'm sure that's very important. I was going to ask you, well, what did China think about this sexual practice?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was really in very remote regions. And, you know, I felt like a fish out of water, and I questioned, what on earth does spiritual sexuality matter here in these places with people who are very involved with their daily lives? And, you know, the furthest thing from their mind is Tantra, you know. They live in a very different culture. It's a Buddhist country. And it was quite different there, believe me.
Yeah.
And, I'd love to talk later on about that connection because I learned a lot of things.
Oh, well, let's talk about it now. I mean, what was the
sure.
I mean, is it sexually shut down, or what was your take on that?
Well, the people I stayed with were monks, and in China I stayed in the Wu Taishan Mountains in a Tibetan monastery, and I was in the middle of a very remote region, and the monks became monks, most of them around 6 to 8 years old, they became monks. So what I found fascinating was you would think, oh, they're very repressed and, you know, they're very remote and distant and they don't know anything about, you know, sexuality. And what I found was the opposite, Veronica. These monks were very friendly and warm, and they had, you just felt such a beauty and such a warm power in their presence. They were very relaxed and open, and they had a very different life than I do, you can imagine. And I found the deeper teachings of spiritual sexuality is not just about, you know, having a lot of sex and so forth. You know, I thought we were going to talk about eco-sexuality today and what that has to do with life. When I was in Nepal, I was standing and facing and looking at Mount Everest, like 14,000 feet. And I'll give you an example. The Nepalese call Mount Everest Sagarmatha, and it means Holy Mother. And then the Tibetans, for millions of years, called it Shomaluma, and this means the mountain so high no bird could fly over it. And we call it Mount Everest. For some guy that was a geologist, a surveyor, you know, his name was Sir George Everest. And yeah, it just, their language, everything about the way they live respects nature, and it's very beloved. Buddhism and monks are intermingled between people where I was staying, and they aren't just these high and lofty and remote figures. They're actually helping the people, and the people are very connected, very involved with them. And where I was staying, there was thousands of monks everywhere. I never knew this existed.
I don't know about you, but to me, this sounds very much about being connected to the earth. You know, and I can picture the mountain as you're describing it, and it sounds quite inspirational.
It was breathtaking. I mean, when you stand there, and it's called Holy Mother, and that's what you feel. It's like, Holy Mother of God, this is like beyond anything I've ever seen. It was so beautiful. It's breathtaking.
And does that kind of awe, that kind of inspiration, does that tie into your concept of ecosexuality, which, you know, this is a topic that's, we need to give a nod to Annie Sprinkle, because I think she coined the term. I'm not sure she wants to take credit for it, but she certainly has popularized it, and, as far as I'm aware of. And I think it's a slippery term, and it's one that's still taking form in a lot.
Absolutely. I think that hardly anybody knows what it means. And first of all, I got to say, I know Annie, and she did endorse the book, and she went to Kudoshka like 30 years ago, very early on, and we had many conversations while I was writing the book, and one of the things that really made a deep impression on her was something called the fire breath, and the fire breath is a way of bringing your body into full body orgasm using your breath. And in this experience, when you bring your body into a full orgasm using your breath, what happens is that you feel your connection through your cells are shivering, and you feel connected to all of life. And Annie said to me that the fire breath made one of the biggest impressions. And I like to think her experience in the Kudoshka teachings and the experience of Kudoshka, because more than anything, Kudoshka is really not a book and it's really not a workshop. It's an experience. And so that experience of feeling connected to everything can happen through our orgastic breath. And that is something that is fundamental to ecosexuality. Before you called, I looked up, I Googled, and my partner and I, Shana, we Googled eco-sex because I wanted to, you know, get what it means. And it can mean anything from this very trendy, interested in green products that you take into the bedroom, you know, green between sheets, I think, and it goes so far, you know, like, and being environmentally...
Organic lubrication,
yes. Yes. You know, I mean, it's like, that's not really what I'm interested in. And, you know, the reason I said yes to the topic you suggested is because I believe that happiness in our intimate life can change the world. I believe that the intimate moments are so sensitive that we can become so sensitive to these moments that we can enhance our connection to life. And ecology means the study of life. It means the study of the evolution of how life changes. So what to me is interesting is about ecosystems that are being sustained by the complex interplay of systems. Ecosexuality to me includes biodiversity. In other words, how life changes. And so I think it should be called evolutionary sex. And it should be, you know, thought of the meaning of eco-sex can be enhanced and deepened. You could say that it's the study of life's changes. And if there's anything that is changing in our time, it certainly is our views and our understanding and our appreciation of sex.
Yes, I think that, I don't know. Now, you know, you and I are pretty immersed in the world of sex, and so it can certainly start to seem that way. Do you think that's happening for other people? You know, I mean, there's like 7.5 billion people on this planet. Do you think that's really a common state of affairs, that sex is redefining itself worldwide?
Well, I don't know about worldwide. I got a lot more traveling to do to say about that. But I do know, I was away for 4 months, so when I came back, and the day I came back, Obama, the President of the United States, was endorsing same-sex marriage.
Yes.
And I mean, I noticed it because I was away. I hadn't looked at a newspaper in a long time, you know, like almost 2 months. And there is a change going on. For me, it was really palpable, and I noticed it because I had been away for so long. And, you know, even 5 years ago, I can't imagine the president of the United States endorsing same-sex marriage. So I do think that there is an evolution of ideas. There is a changing world of perceptions about what's acceptable sexually. I don't know if it's worldwide. I don't think they're thinking about same-sex marriage in Nepal, but they're thinking about it here.
Absolutely. And it's the president of Iran was trying to tell us that there's some gay people in his country.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's crazy. But I think it's exciting. Can I share with you about, you know, something I did yesterday?
Absolutely. Please do.
Well, I came back. I've been back this season. The first thing I did when I got back was a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, asked me to facilitate an alternative marriage. And they didn't want to even call it a marriage. It was a sacred union. And they didn't want to take conventional vows of living happily ever after. They wanted to do something different, something, you know, out of the box. They wanted a celebration that had real meaning for them, not something handed down to them that was rote. Yet they wanted something very sacred, very special, a celebration of their union. And most importantly, they didn't want to make a pretend promise or a vow to live happily ever after, you know, something to have a party and spend lots of money and then forget about. They really wanted to share this experience with their friends. So they asked me to facilitate and make a ceremony that could be shared both with family members that were more conventional, and then, you know, they're into having multiple lovers. And, you know, they didn't want to just be in a relationship. They wanted to have something special. And they really wanted to let their community, let their friends and their family, which was a stretch for them, to let their whole community know that they were making a commitment to be together for the rest of their lives, understanding that things change, understanding that they may not be together forever, that they life brings changes. So, you know, I called it having a evolutionary relationship ceremony, and really they helped me to co-create it, and it was fantastic. It was really amazing what happened.
Evolutionary relationship ceremony. Now that's a beautiful concept, because now you're talking about something that's dynamic and open to change. And how does one do a ritual for that? Because, of course, most people are used to hearing things like "till death do us part" and, you know, some rather rigid, or at least until we don't love each other anymore. But usually it's kind of some rigid ideas about how love should stand out there all by itself forever and ever in the same place.
Well, that was the cool thing about the ceremony, Veronica, was it was very important to them that they co-created it with me, that it wasn't something that I created for them. They had a hand in creating it, and so we did things like they had a men's circle and a woman's circle, and the women prepared the bride, if you will, and prepared her for this union. And the men, we all got together, and I don't think I should share what we actually did, but I'll just say that it was wild. We told stories of a certain kind, and so they revved up this man, and so they just got him prepared in a place of ecstasy to make this, you know, declaration of union. And so we bonded with the women, and then we bonded with the men, and then we did what's called a beauty circle, where we gave reflections and blessings and prayers for their magical union. You know, we were talking about the sexual practices of Kwadoshka, and the word Kwadoshka means when two energies, separate energies, come together, two people, come together in such a way that their union creates more than the sum of the two individual parts. In other words, Kodoshka is about when two energies together, more is created, magic is created. So this was very much a celebration of their magic of union, and it was about sharing this with the community.
Now this is, that I think this is very true about romantic connections, that when there is intense intimacy, you are co-creating. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're creating a baby. I mean, that's like one thing you can do with sexual energy, but you can co-create a life, of course, in the circumstances of cohabitating, if that's what you're choosing to do. But I think also if you start to create another reality, a shared reality and a shared vision of life, and that starts to permeate everything you do, and that it can create a different direction for your life, so that you become more as two than you would be by yourself, obviously, but also more than the sum total of the parts, as it were. It's more profound than that. There's some kind of synergy that takes place.
Yeah, you know, well, like this couple, for example, and I think there's a lot of couples out there. They had been married before. They were, you know, over 50, and they had, one was a mother. She was a mother, and her children had grown, and she was ready to begin a new relationship in a different way, and the old ways didn't fit. And so you're exactly right in what you said, that they came together to give birth to their dream, to give birth to their vision of what this relationship could be. And they made a commitment. One of the things they did was they made a commitment to speak the unspeakable, to, you know, create what I call conscious sexual agreements. And this is one of the things that they really wanted me to share with their whole community was, you know, how do you make sexual agreements that allow both two things, both safety and freedom? And those are the, when you get down to it, those are the bottom line issues. I think that's what evolutionary sexual relationships are about, evolutionary friendships, is that we get to have the comfort and security of being together safely with someone who will take care of you in sickness and in health. I love that part of the marriage vow. And also allow the freedom to have your attractions to others. And then how are you going to deal with those things? How are you going to deal with emotions and jealousy and the fears that come up? And so we talked a lot about these things to people that had never heard of such a thing. I mean, half of the audience was, you know, people they knew that were friends of theirs who understood their relationship, their alternative relationship, and half of the people were, rather shocked. They were like, "What? You know, this is." But we all came together in this, and that's what I feel is one aspect of eco-sex that is incredible. It's about biodiversity of sexuality, that each of us can create relationships in our own way that work for us.
Biodiversity of relationships. That's a beautiful thought.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've been around the planet for 5 million years, and I think that there have been a few evolutionary changes in sexual beliefs, that our culture is shifting, and therefore not everyone, but some people, mostly on the fringes and the pioneers and on the edges or periphery of culture, they are, in every trend, are producing a shift that it's hard to see for me and you, Veronica, because we're in the middle of it. But I just noticed it so much when I got back that there are shifting beliefs. And I still love and honor the traditional beliefs. I mean, my parents were married for over 50 years, and I think there's just as much beauty in having a traditional relationship that is monogamous and people are, you know, loving being together. I think that's a fantastic way to live. But there's also there's a lot of people moving into the new phases of their life where that box doesn't fit.
Well, you know, I actually had Deborah Anna Paul on my podcast not so long ago about her new book on polyamory in the 21st century. One of the things that I loved about her comment was that she said, you know, some of the principles about polyamory really apply to monogamy too. And I think that whole idea of being able to move in and out of relationship modalities so that you don't, it's kind of like sexuality too. Or people have in the past felt like, well, you're either straight or you're gay or you're bisexual, you need to pick a side and stick to it. And what I've noticed with people is it's much more fluid than that. People are kind of, you know, reinventing themselves as they go. And I think the same can apply for relationships. You might be more promiscuous at one time, more abstinent at another time, more monogamous, and then more polyamorous. And that it's really about trying to stay connected with what's true and what's real for you in the moment.
I agree, and I think that's why I wrote my book, Sexual Agreements, because that's, you're saying a lot there. I mean, how do you navigate that territory of changing and right. And what, who am I now? And there's a lot of stuff that comes up that we don't have the tools or the tradition of how to navigate this. Of how do you get through all the stuff that comes up? How do you move through jealousy? How do you end a relationship in a beautiful way? There's lots of people doing this now. We have a very different concept of staying together for 50 years. It happens. It's more rare. And so what happens when you're back into the dating world and you got to go find a new lover, only now, you know, you're 50 or 60 and, you know, you have a whole other set of issues that you were concerned with, and yet you're trying to, you know, operate with you know, old systems that don't fit this, you know, like when do you have sex and on the first date and so forth. And all just kinds of different things come up for us that are constantly evolving. And so I think one of the keys to having a really happy relationship, an evolutionary relationship, is, as you say, is riding through changes and having the tools to communicate honestly, and that is really the key to the whole thing, to communicate honestly. You got to be willing to speak the unspeakable, to say what's not working. And so we had a tremendous ceremony about speaking the unspeakable, and that's something else that we don't know how to do in our relationships. And you know, we call it a fight.
And people try to avoid those at all costs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just had somebody posted something to my wall. I've often signed my book, The Truth is Always Better. And a reader said that she and her husband, or partner, actually, I'm not sure they're married, were celebrating 5 years of being together. And that they were just really excited about the fact that they had been practicing this idea of speaking their truth and sharing their truth with each other instead of being afraid of that, and that it's really worked for them. And they were thanking me for that. But that's something I encourage people to do, you know, to be honest. And I realize that not everybody out there is going to feel comfortable being completely honest with the people in their lives, but certainly we need to be honest with ourselves first and foremost. And there's so many people out there that are so, you know, burdened with sexual shame. They can't even get honest with themselves about, you know, what turns them on, what they prefer, what they like, what they don't like, or even what they do. Sometimes people are almost split in two. They're kind of like denying this huge part of themselves. And it's really sad. To me, ecosexuality denotes how sex permeates every facet of existence on this planet. But to really show up for that, I feel like the definition of sex has to be expanded. If you look at the dictionary, it tries to make it all about penises and vaginas, which pretty much eliminates all my queer friends and all of my kinky friends. They're not even having sex by the dictionary definition. So I think we need a new definition of sex. And I, to me, like somebody asked me one time, you know, what's your definition of sex? And I said, well, I'm sitting at my desk and I'm writing something that I'm really passionate about. And there's two bird feeders, one to my left and one to my right. And as the birds are eating the food that I've provided for them, I can feel their heart chakras emanating. And it permeates my heart, goes into my heart, and I breathe them in while I'm writing. And to me, this is a form of sex as I see it. But I have a really expanded view of sex. And to me, it's all about energy, and energy that makes you feel alive and engaged and connected. And I wonder what you think about that, Amara.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that the sexual energy courses through everything, that there isn't anything in existence that wasn't come about through an act of sex. So we come through an act of sex. It's coursing through our body, this energy. And so I totally agree that the expanding view of sexuality and expanding it to mean way more than just what happens in the bedroom, that sexuality really is about our connection to whatever is around us, whatever is near us. I like to think that the most beautiful thing that I experienced when I was traveling was that moving a blade of grass in China affects something here. Just as the effect of our touch, of our sensuous connection with someone, how delicately and sensitive we are, or how powerful and how true we are and pure we are with the energy that we feel, that this can affect someone in China in some unknown way. That, in fact, all of our actions and our words and our thoughts do indeed matter. What we say in Kwadoshka is that we are truly intimately connected and interdependent and interreliable with all forms of all things. And the more that we're alive and attuned to the fact that we are connected to all forms of all things, we're interdependent, we're interconnected with all of life, that is Kwadoshka. That is spiritual sexuality. We call it Shulakwe Kwadoshka. And, you know, that's what older cultures, bottom line to me, are more in tune with. They feel that connection. They allow that connection to happen in their life. And we think sexuality is about being gay or this having this belief or that belief. And you're right. The expansion of the meaning of the word sex changes your whole life. When you start to see that each and every action is interconnected, is interdependent, interreliable on everything, you start to move differently in the world. You start to speak to people differently. You touch differently as a lover. You even dream differently because you know that your dreams are connected and that you do matter. In ecosexuality, in nature, it's a complete illusion that we are alone and in separate from the universe. So how can you be ashamed of yourself? How can you have shame if you are a cell in Great Spirit's body? You know, are you one of the cells that Great Spirit didn't pay attention to and didn't like and you didn't give enough to? Or is it really true that, you know, you are a living and breathing cell in Great Spirit's body, and therefore you are beautiful. There is it's just a fact. There's no other way of looking at it. And I know sometimes we don't feel that way, and sometimes it's hard to remember that. But I live as a live expression of Great Spirit's cell. I'm breathing Great Spirit. We're not separated here, even on this phone line, and even through the internet. There's a connection, and maybe there's one person listening to this, and maybe there's 100. I don't know. It doesn't matter. That's the cool part. By the way, all the monks have iPads now, and they have iPhones.
Oh my God! Do they really?
Yeah.
That's like,
it was really funny. I saw so many monks with iPhones. I couldn't believe it. It was great.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's great.
Exciting about that. What's so exciting about that? And I know there's a lot of people who don't even have indoor plumbing in third world countries who have, PDAs and smartphones. So what is very exciting about that, of course, things like Arab Spring and some of the social movements that have been birthed just by, Twitter and cell phones. But it's just, we really are so close to each other. And this planet has really shrunk.
In a way, yeah. I mean, it's bizarre because of the cheap technology. They all have cell phones. But, when you're walking up the path to Mount Everest and you're going into these remote regions and you see these Sherpas and they're talking to their girlfriend. I'm not kidding. Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it's great because, hey, why shouldn't they talk to their girlfriend, right?
Right.
On the other hand, all those vibrations there, the place is not the same. They talk about ecology and things. It's constantly changing. And so, you want to think that there's quaint and remote places where we did go high enough where the phones and no computers work and, nothing works. So that was nice to get away from it for a while. And I really noticed it. It took me about a month to decompress and to lose the habit of checking in, and it was great. After a while, I had to connect with the people I was with instead of constantly checking in Facebook to see if anybody had liked something of mine.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
When I got the BlackBerry, I said, okay, I know why they call it Crackberry. It's with you, everywhere you go. When you wake up in the morning, when you go to bed at night, it's insane. And I just recently moved from a mountain retreat that I've been living in now for about 8 years, where I did not have cell phone coverage. And and it's a mixed blessing to be this wired in and this connected. I can text people whenever I feel like it, which I love. I can just ask them quick questions. And in that sense, it just opens up this whole new world. However, I absolutely agree that it is a different energy. If you are running that connected energy, you're not getting soulful and quiet in yourself.
I got to tell you, when you make it, I made love during that time when all that was turned off. And I honestly, I could really feel the difference. I just, there wasn't all this interference. And it taught me something. Turn off the phones, turn off the text, turn off the mind and put that stuff down for a while and really, connect with your lover and just be there. I was so nourished. I was nourished for weeks because we were traveling up in places where it was so cold and so high, and you get altitude sickness and stuff. See, we didn't make love a lot, but when we did, it was just like very, very sweet, very pure, very beautiful. It was great.
Yes, well, when I get together with my beloved, I'd like to, not always, but at least for a certain, for a day or two, just no phone, no nothing.
Good. That's good.
Stuff.
Well, good. We give some advice to your listeners. That would be it. Is just, put the distractions down. If you want to be nourished by yourself, I mean, ecosexuality in the end is really about balance and feeding, getting fed from intimacy and touch.
So putting down the distractions, I saw a lot of the stress that we have is accentuated, is amplified by all the stuff that we make up that we have to do. I mean, when I wasn't doing all the stuff, I was telling my partner was like, you would just have one thing to think about, maybe two or three, maybe a top. It's about three things you had to do. Oh, I have to pack my suitcase today. And that was about it, you know. I didn't have 10 zillion things, this person I need to call, and this person I need to call, and this thing I need to finish, and da-da-da-da. And so I was lucky. I was really fortunate to experience a time of being able to focus and just do one thing at a time. And I hope that feeling lasts.
Yes, and that kind of sinking into a connection with your lover is just so important. If you want to encourage intimacy and great sex, I think it's just so important to have that. And, you know, there's a lot of women in the world who are just rushing to trying to hurry up with the orgasm, and, you know, men who are riddled with performance anxiety, and everybody's got, you know, a vibrator at the ready trying to get it done apparently before, they have to go to bed for their job the next morning, whatever. But it seems like people sometimes have a really hard time. I know when I'm working with my clients, just asking them to set aside a half hour to an hour becomes like, oh, I don't know if we have time for that. So Amara, when we're talking about expanding our concept of sex or sexuality, I know that one of the things that I've been noticing is how there just seems to be a blueprint in the life here on planet Earth, especially when I think about life for mammals. Mammals seem to really be built for sexual connection almost at every level. You think about how there is sexual stimulation that accompanies breastfeeding, and mammals are all about breastfeeding. That's what defines them, because mammals, you know, mammaries. And now we're finding, thanks to people like Christiane Northrup, Dr. Northrup has been really putting the whole orgasmic birth thing out there. And so women's bodies in a lot of ways are just these beautiful orgasm machines. I mean, it's like they can have orgasm at the moment of conception, orgasm at the moment of birth, orgasm while breastfeeding. And in some ways, I think this suppression of female sexuality has really centered around the idea that we would become confused about where the line is, that somehow or another we wouldn't know what is sex and what isn't sex. And so we've really culturally seemed driven to creating motherhood apart from sex. And I, as an incest survivor, I understand some of the sensitive issues that are at stake here about, but I also was just horrified to find that there's some young mothers who are online in chat rooms trying to find out if breastfeeding is child molesting. And I wonder what you have to say about this.
I think that, people, men and women, the most important thing is to just quit listening to all this nonsense and to get in touch with yourself and start asking yourself, what do I feel? A lot of times we just go outward for help and assistance, and I understand, the need to do that. What we fail to do is listen to our own bodies, listen to ourselves. The joy that I've talked to so many women, this is just one example, so many women who experience the joy of the feeling of connection with their child when they're breastfeeding. I mean, it's sex, it's sensuous. I'm not a mother, but I've had a baby suckle on my breast. I mean, my God, it was one of the most beautiful, sexy things I've ever felt. It was so pure and so sweet. And so one of my teachers says, people will die over concepts. They'll try to eat concepts. In other words, you read something on the internet that says that breastfeeding is molestation, and you'll believe that concept of some probably Sir George Everest wrote about and, you know, said, and then you believe that more than yourself. And so it go for seeing what's true for you first. And sometimes that means you've got to experience something yourself first instead of asking others or looking it up or Googling it. Start to live on your own experiences. That's what Kwadoshka gets you back in touch with. That's what the book is all about, is getting back to how do you ask yourself, what do I feel? What do I believe? What are the things that I was brought up with that are nonsense, that don't work? What are other people telling me that is just theirs for whatever reason? I mean, who made it up? That's a ridiculous idea, that breastfeeding is molestation. Well, how do you think that the millions of people on the planet get milk and get fed? Do you think they have formulas or something? You know? I mean, you know, come on. And,
well, I think
people are more intelligent than this. I believe that when you give people the opportunity and you encourage them to, you know, experience things for themselves, they can make up their own minds of what's real and what's true.
I think you began our conversation this evening by speaking about embodiment. And,
yeah.
And I think that this is really a vital, perhaps a key component of the whole concept of ecosexuality is about embodiment, and it's very much about returning to our connection. That animals are not our inferiors, but rather, fellow travelers on this planet, that our bodies are not what separates us from the divine, but can actually create a doorway to divine enlightenment.
I love that. I feel that that's really true, and I love what you're saying. And I like to approach those things in ways that, you know, people can relate to. Because sometimes when we start talking about the divine, and I use that title. I mean, I just did a workshop called Voices of the Divine Feminine. But I like to bring it down to earth. Okay, well, what does that mean, divine? How do you get divine when you're not feeling so divine? So I like to talk about the ecosexuality as I'll just pare it down to the two aspects. One is the feminine part of a relationship, the yin part, the goddess part, if you will. That feminine part is the part of us that wants to be held, that wants to be secure, that wants to feel taken care of, whether you're a man or a woman. I'm not talking about men and women here. And the part that wants to be nurtured and, cared for. The yang part is that creative, the outward-directed, moving energy, that part that wants to be more freedom, have more freedom. And so it's about balancing those two aspects, the safety and the comfort and the security with someone you love, and the freedom to explore, to create, to have new ideas. And we get together in relationship for both those things. And too often in a relationship, it feels too constricting, and so there isn't any freedom, or it feels so safe that it's like a dead zone where you're so comfort and secure and everything is so predictable that you just get very dull. And so for me, ecosexuality is about having that dynamic balance. When I say balance, it doesn't mean it's the same, that that masculine creativity gets to explore and be unpredictable, and then that feminine place of comfort and security inside can be very very, very sweet. Because I know for me in my relationship, I like to have both of those things. Sometimes
as a woman, I love to be wild and outgoing and creative. And then sometimes I like to be tranquil and quiet and secure and just safe. And so what I saw, you know,
Amara, we're out of time.
Oh my God. Well,
we're out of
time. Oh,
I want to make sure people know how to reach you.
Thank you, honey.
Which, your website is amaracharles.com, and they can find your book on Amazon, and also they can have sessions with you. So I'm sure you've had so much to share. I'm sure people are going to want to contact you. Should they reach you through your website then, amaracharles.com?
Yeah, amaracharles.com, and the Sexual Practices of Kudoshka, it's on Amazon. And on my website, I have special bundles and things on my website. Thank you very much, Veronica.
Thank you. It was just a really eco-sexuality, a very fabulous topic. Congratulations on your book, and thank you for sharing your world travels with us. It's very enlightening.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, babe. And I look forward to, you know, actually meeting you. I've had several fantastic conversations.
Yes.
I can't wait to meet you.
I can't wait either. All right. Amara Charles, thanks so much for tuning into the Shame-Free Zone, and we will be back next Monday night. Thanks.
Love it. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you'd like to chat and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak menutup kabar berita?